Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your Cognitive Rampage. You have to believe in the power of you. Uncomfortable is where the change is. Welcome to Cognitive Rampage Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Lowry, as always. Joining me in studio, Miss Robin Hoffman.
In the studio.
You sing too?
Oh, I do everything.
Nice. I wish I could sing.
Yeah?
I wish.
Anybody can sing. Doesn't mean we always sound good.
Right.
Anybody can sing.
I was going to say, yeah, if I could sing, I would just sing to everyone.
And everything. That's why my poor kids, I do. I'll be like, good morning, and just sing everything.
Nice. My Patricia sings. She sings a lot.
Yay.
She sings about sometimes.
I can't wait to hear.
She will certainly do it.
Awesome.
Will certainly do it. Now before we get chatting, usually Patricia does all the producer work here. So I just want to double check the page here that we got good sound. Sometimes it's weird. When I go live, it'll chipmunk the voices.
Oh, okay.
It's strange. I've done an entire 2-hour podcast and didn't check it and went back and went, oh, no.
That's fantastic. I love the chipmunks.
Who was your favorite?
Well, you know, Alvin was kind of reckless, so you got to love that in somebody. Yeah. We could diagnose each of them. We could sit here and diagnose Alvin, Simon, and Theodore.
I would agree. I'm an Alvin fan, but it's the A he wore in his shirt, so I'm biased.
Oh. All right. I could see that.
So let's walk back into your life, if you don't mind, now that you're on the couch.
I will let you walk into my life.
So, background, where you came from, what it was like. Walk me through it, man.
Wow.
Let me know, Robin.
I was born on a cold morning in November. So I was born in New York, and I moved to Florida a long time ago. I was 10 years old, and I met someone. This is actually my old stomping ground.
Here. Oh,
yes.
No kidding.
I grew up in Deltona, went to DeLand High School until they opened Deltona High School, and we were the second graduating class of Deltona High School. And then once I crossed that bridge and moved over into Seminole County, I was like, I'm never going back.
Never
and
going
I never did.
Back. I love
except
how you,
to come here.
I love how you use the other city, not where we're
yes.
at. People will find me. I appreciate that.
No problem.
Yes, we're definitely in Deltona, people. That's where we are.
Sorry.
No.
Volusia County was my stomping ground is what I meant to say.
Yeah, we're actually not in Deltona.
No,
so.
You're not?
No.
Not at all.
Right, we're on the border.
Yeah. But my sister lives in the same city that you live in.
Oh.
Very close.
Nice.
Yeah.
Man, some people, when I tell them to come out to the studio, I think it was Kermit Gonzalez was the first one that brought it up. He's like, my God, man. He's like, I needed my passport to come all the way over here. I'm like, I'm surprised they let you because
right.
you're Mexican.
That's so
I can
funny.
Say that. My girlfriend's Mexican.
Oh, good. It allows you. You've got some. I get to make fun of stuff, too. My husband's Japanese.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
You're in.
Yeah.
That's the only reason I would date that, so I can crack those jokes.
You have to be able to, right?
I'm
going to
get emails. Get emails,
we
Robin.
Welcome them. We're kidding, people. Senses of humor.
Right.
Is it senses of humor? Or sense of humors? No. Sense of...
Man. I don't know.
I don't know.
It's like, why does
Do
the glue not dry in the
this
bottle?
These are things that bother me. Like, when people write LOL.
Yeah.
No, no. Or they'll say LOLS, like they're laughing. No. It's LSOL. You laugh.
You no. laughed out loud.
Laughs out loud, not laughed out louds.
Oh, right. Right? Yeah.
Anyway.
All right.
I think we've shifted.
This will happen. This will happen. I will squirrel us off many times.
Oh, yes. We were talking about me.
Of course.
Oh.
Stomping grounds.
Let's get back to that.
Back home at stomping grounds and
yeah.
then crossed over.
Then I went to UCF. Good game the other night, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't sound like I actually watched it.
Yeah. They kicked me out of there. Twice.
No. Twice. They had to kick you out twice. You
yeah.
came back.
Yeah. They let me back.
This
that was
is
the
a
surprise.
Story. But it's not about you today, Adam.
Oh, I'll. Make it about me.
I'm
don't
just
worry.
Kidding. It's totally about you. It's your podcast.
See, I'm aware that I'm a narcissist, so it It brings down the level of narcissism.
Yes. Those make the best mental health counselors.
Yeah, I would think so.
Those of the narcissistic kind.
Right. Or does that make you more narcissistic that you think you're aware that you're a narcissist, so then you're actually twice the narcissist?
Oh, let's dig. Dig deep.
I don't know. I'm screwed up. I'll just we can go with that.
So on that note, I got my degree in psychology at UCF.
Nice. Now yes. I get to be analyzed.
I know. I do. Well, I naturally did it before I even went to school for it.
Oh, all right.
Always. It was my thing. And I was in a behavior therapy class, and the professor showed us a video with an autistic child. Now, you have to remember, this is way back. All right, guys, I'm old. It was 1991,
yeah.
And autism was not a household name. People did not know what it was. In fact, forgive me, but I'm going to say, you know, a lot of terms have changed in mental health. And way, way back when, I'm not using the term, I'm just telling you the terminology, they used the term idiot savant.
Yes.
Do you remember hearing that?
I do. Well, that was became a kind of a household thing with the Rain Man movie.
Correct. Correct. And then it was correctly diagnosed and correctly named autism.
Yeah.
And now autism spectrum disorders. But
right.
I was
I realize I didn't button this. I'm looking all Rico Suave
can
right
you,
now.
Yeah, can you?
I didn't realize
Can you
that.
Button up a bit? I was wondering.
I was like, oh boy. I looked down. I was like, whoa. All right there, buddy. If I go one more, I can be
there you go.
Cholo. Sorry.
That's all good. So I was so just taken with this video of this child with autism. And I went up to the professor at the end of class. I was very driven back then. And I said, where do they work with children like this? So he told me of a place in Orlando. I got in my car. I was 18 years old, got in my car, drove to this facility, asked for the manager. And I said, I want you to train me how to work with these children. And she said, okay.
So what I started training. What was the draw?
Autism still fascinates me. And crazy thing, years later, I have a daughter with autism.
Oh,
yeah.
Almost like you were preparing
it
yourself.
It was like I was prepared. And to be honest, I've said it so many times as a parent. I have five kids, by the way. But she happens to be on the spectrum. And I've told myself I would have been lost had I not been so trained. And I was so trained because I worked with severely autistic kids at the time. And then I became a certified behavior analyst. And I just kept going. And 26 years later, here I am.
Wow. Yeah, well, I had a gentleman on the podcast, his name eludes me, it was about 2 years ago.
Okay.
That was all his specialty. That's exactly what he was into. And you know, it was revealing a lot of things. The idea of the spectrum, right? Is autism increasing, or is the actual awareness of it increasing?
Correct.
Or did they widen spectrums? What's your take on that?
I think there's both.
Yeah.
I think, especially because of Rain Man, I hate to say it, but that movie kind of enlightened all of us a little bit to what autism was. It wasn't exactly accurate, but it did, you know, make us curious. And then because of behavior therapy, the therapy changed. And with behavior therapy, kids were more functional. You know, back in the day when I first started, they were still putting kids away in homes. They weren't keeping them in their own home. Mm. And therapy changed dramatically, and people learned. I actually went into people's homes and helped them write behavior programs and taught parents how to raise their children. So now we have a slew of kids who may not have even been noticed before, been able to thrive, and now they're being treated in the way they should be treated, and they're being raised in a way where they're going to college, and now they're getting married, and they're having kids of their own. So think about genetically, we are absolutely increasing more of the spectrum.
Yeah, wow. I never really looked at it as that the behavioral interventions early allow for a more functional life.
So,
that makes a lot of sense. And man, I'm sorry I can't remember your name out there. I'll come and add it on or something. But he talks so much about how important early intervention was.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It just, I mean, obviously, think about it. For all of us, that's our learning curve. They say you learn all you're supposed to learn in kindergarten.
Yeah.
So imagine after that, it just gets harder and harder because those behaviors are just ingrained and that becomes muscle memory and all those things that make it stay. So early intervention is absolutely key. And in any, you know that, in any behavioral or mental health capacity.
Sure, except for maybe narcissism, right?
Well, you just can't be fixed there, baby.
Yeah, you're done. Well, more often I'm seeing inside of addiction facilities or mental health, it doesn't have to be addiction, mental health treatment facilities, men and women coming in that are on the spectrum and weren't noticed and kind of fly on the radar. I've often said that sometimes it's almost better to be on the more moderate, severe end than under the radar at the mild of any diagnosis.
So it's noticed.
Right. And mm-hmm. over time, you tend to fly under the radar just enough until time or life catches up with you.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden it's like, wait, what? You know, there's a few in the facility I'm at now that had no idea.
Wow.
Had no idea, you know, and
there are people that get diagnosed as adults because, again, back when we were younger, when I was younger, I think I'm a little bit older than you. It wasn't known, and people were being pushed aside because they didn't know how to handle it or didn't know how to cope or thought they couldn't be taught. You know, now we know better. Now we know that absolutely can be taught, but we have to get into their world rather than bringing them into our world.
Ah, what a much better way to look at that is what we yeah. do see is trying to teach the operations from our end. Yes. Tell me kind of about some of the treatment, the research you did on it, and, you know, just to educate maybe some parents or some people out there that don't understand or what to do maybe or what to or what to look for. I'm feeding you
help.
So you can
look for help because it's out there. There are so many resources, beautiful, wonderful resources out there for you. Even if it's not at an early age and you think, you know, I've seen kids in college get evaluated and find out they're on the spectrum. So, you know, there are a few things that have to be happening. There's behavioral issues, repetitive behaviors, those types of things. And in order to have an autism spectrum disorder, you have to have sensory issues as well. So some sort of sensory issues, meaning light bothers you, touch bothers you in some way. It doesn't have to be all of the senses, but at least, you know, multiple senses. I've often said that I'm probably on the spectrum somewhere, and it is literally a spectrum. So you can, you know, be on the far end or either way. But I definitely have sensory issues. But you can have sensory issues and not be autistic, but you can't be autistic without having some sensory issues. Mm. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So I have an extremely sensitive sense of smell. So if I walk into a room and something's powerful, even if it's a candle or something that somebody might be enjoying.
Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Oh,
I can
know.
Taste it.
Oh, can you?
Yeah, so it gets like...
So you taste the charcoal mist.
It's beautiful.
That's behind you. There's like, you're surrounded by candles all behind you right now.
I'll be honest, it's diminished a little bit as I get older, which is nice because it used to just be, it was brutal. It was like a smack in the face sometimes. I would get headaches and bright lights still bother me. My eyes are super sensitive. No, you're fine. I'm actually getting used to it because I'm on film all the time
right.
now.
Yeah, with your show.
So I have the lights in front of me. So my eyes are adapting a little bit. But if I walk from a dark place to a bright place, it's painful. And that's how I understand children with autism so much nicer too, because I feel some of that. And that's what I try to explain to somebody. If I was working with a professor or a teacher, I'd say, like, this isn't just an inconvenience. This can be painful. So if there's a student who's sitting in your class and you have those fluorescent lights going on and or those lights that make that really high-pitched sound that you might not notice all the time, right?
Yeah.
For them, it's brutal. So how can they pay attention to what you're saying and learn
when
they're trying so easy? Sometimes sunglasses or even some earbuds, anything that we can do to help them be able to concentrate on what you're saying rather than concentrating on the pain that they could or the discomfort that they're feeling from those sensory issues can change their entire, you know, process there.
I mean, I got to imagine how often maybe or maybe a parent that may be in this that denial phase. Oh. I mean,
you know that happens in every category of mental health
sure.
or diagnosis in any capacity. Denial is a huge factor, and it's not helpful. It's not helpful to the parent. It's not helpful to the child, because how can we help them to the best that we can? To me, a diagnosis is a diagnosis. Shoot, give them all day long. I love it because I like to know what we're dealing with and
yeah.
and how we can help. It doesn't mean anything except how, you know, how we can treat or how we can help you.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of parents, I could imagine, right, yourself maybe or those on how to cope with that denial factor. You know, what are some of the testing issue or the testing procedures for going that way?
For autism?
Yeah.
In general? Things have changed drastically since
sure.
I've been involved. So things are probably, so you guys correct me when I'm wrong, not if. But they did a battery
we're gonna get
test. It's usually, you usually start, depending on their school age, you want to do an IQ test, obviously, and then sensory, you do a behavioral checklist, you do the parent fills it out, and if the kid's old enough, they can fill one out. Just, you know, all those different categories that require to get diagnosed with autism.
Yeah. Certainly, if you know, I would encourage the parents out there, anybody, you know, feeling like that or struggling or maybe those sensory issues, yes. you know, get early intervention for sure.
For sure. And now that it's more recognized, you could probably go through your healthcare provider or through, you know, your health insurance. It's not like it used to be where you had to find, you know, it was difficult to find one medical, you know, professional in this field. Now it's out there.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, right, in the mental health and addiction treatment side, if a person is diagnosed with autism at any level of the spectrum, insurance will not cover their inpatient treatment.
Why? Because that comes first. Is that the primary diagnosis?
And it can't be cured, in quotes.
Whoa, but addiction's separate and can be. And they can be addicted to something to try and numb some of those.
Nope. We won't do it.
Okay.
I completely disagree. But
right.
the idea
with
is
them, not me.
Right. Right. No, yeah, right. With you, with that idea. Well, I rarely agree with an insurance company. you know, but yeah, we're finding that is because being, even though it's a comorbid diagnosis,
yes.
it's still the presenting and they consider the
is
lead.
Is that true for other diagnoses? What if they're schizophrenic or bipolar?
Nope. Acceptable.
What?
Yeah, acceptable. Yep. Any comorbid disorder, but if autism has been diagnosed mm-hmm. Or even near the spectrum and the addiction is there, you know, they may cover 6 days. They'd be short. If anything, it'd be more like a detox coverage type deal. But many insurance companies will deny length of coverage because there's no, we're not, one, if especially if we're not a behavioral autism oriented mm-hmm. treatment center, it's a no. No, because the no cure quotes.
That's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw some recently.
But you're not trying to cure the autism. You're trying to cure addiction.
Yeah.
Or not cure. Help.
Yeah. No, it's amazing, man. Like, it's tragic.
It's tragic.
Yeah, I will go off on a whole thing about, you know, insurance companies. Because for me, when I'll reel it in. Don't worry.
You're fine. I love this. I could do this all day long.
Yeah. When I first jumped in the game in 2013, fighting the powers that be, I was going at the treatment facilities directly. And pharmaceutical companies overriding prescriptions to physicians doing that, right? And the deeper now 5 years into that fight, yes, there are some terrible facilities. Yes, there are some doctors that overprescribe and pass them out like M&Ms and Pez. Yes, this happens. But there are a lot that don't. And there are a lot of good facilities
right.
that get a bad rap because they're trying to fight within a corrupt system. And the root of that, really, the more I'm, you know, after 5 years into it, really is the insurance system that's perpetrating that and making good facilities have to cut corners, run thin lines, you know, undercut actual treatment they could do. You know, as a practitioner myself, I spend probably 60% of my time on paperwork and charting and 40% actually doing therapy.
Just to follow the rules of the insurance company.
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. Not the facilities, right? And, you know, there's so many times I go, I wish I could just come here and help people.
Right.
Can I just do groups? Right. Can I just do therapy with people?
That's what I got in this to do. Right.
Yeah. And I can't. I spend at least 60% of my time. I come home after work and I'll be charting for another 3 hours at my home just trying to catch up. Given 60% of my day already went to charting.
Right.
You know, and then the UR people that are literally at war with the insurance companies trying to get a patient extended days or lengthen those times forces us to have to chart to a deficit, not proving growth or change yeah. over time. And on a macro scale, right, what's happening now is insurance companies are, this addiction, mental health related, are cutting down the ability, trimming their networks. So if you live in a city, say Orlando, and you want treatment, there's no more going to Fort Lauderdale, Atlanta. They're cutting that back. So you have to treat locally now in network. So in response, facilities or companies that own facilities are merging. So they're trying to soak up as many facilities. So, hey, we're in your network now. They can't say we're not in your network. So you have this massive growth going on and monopolizing in the facility industry, in the treatment industry, trying to keep up with the insurance companies so they can keep making money. Insurance companies I'm telling you, trim and cutting and trimming. Right. No, we're not doing this, not doing this. You have to prove so many things. And then the practitioners, doctors as well, physicians, mm-hmm. are getting that pressure from both sides, from the facility trying to stay in line by the governing bodies and insurance companies, and then while trying to treat, and it's the practitioners, the therapists, the physicians, right, that are just getting weight. They have to bear the weight of all this stuff. It's just...
And on the micro level, we just want to help people.
Right.
So
yes.
Let us do our jobs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's rough. But yeah, so... back to me.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
No. So how long did you do that? How long were you treating autism and helping families?
That particular facility that I went to when I was in college, I made it just a little over 9 months. It was very, very challenging, physically challenging. We did a lot at that time. We did a lot of restraining, things that they might not do now. But it was necessary at that point. This was to protect them from hurting themselves.
Right.
So my last injury was a concussion.
Oh my gosh.
I got headbutted and I passed out. Like, he knocked me out. So when I woke up,
wow, you took a shot.
I took a shot. I decided, you know, I want to still help and I want to still learn, but maybe I have to do this in a place where I'm not getting hurt.
You see that a lot. Actually, I've seen a few articles published about nurses, ER nurses, and staff being assaulted numerous times. Like, it's a major issue.
Right. In this case, you know, these kids didn't know what they were doing.
Right.
They were large kids. They ran all the way up to 18 years old. So it wasn't, you know, small children that were hurting me. Well, the little ones were. We had one that was... hyperflexible, or however you'd say, and he would get his fingers in your hair and like just wind them up. Oh, it was bad.
And there's no sense of it's full powerful. There's no sense of like sort of doing something.
Correct.
When an autistic person goes into that,
they get stronger and they can keep that up for a very long time, longer than any of us would be able to.
AKA superhuman.
Superhuman.
Right?
When they want to be, for sure. And then, so I continued and I finished my education and, like I said, became a certified behavior analyst. And I worked within the school system and I also did private, where I would go into people's homes and help with behavior programs. And then I was having kids of my own and,
thank God you had all the behavioral skills necessary.
Thank goodness. Oh, my poor kids had charts and graphs and stuff.
Oh, no, they did.
Oh, they did.
Robin.
They did. That. On the wall so they could see it. Stickers and everything that they were able to put the stickers on themselves. It was, oh, those poor kids. But they're great now. They're all good kids.
I was raised on Post-it notes from my mom, so I get it. And she worked her butt off, so I would wake up to Post-it notes, come home to Post-it notes of what to do, where to put up. I rarely got stars, but... in school or at home.
Oh, come on now. So then I got to the point where I wanted to work with older individuals. So I started at the college level and I worked 8 years at the college level and I loved it. And I got some really great experience. I worked with people with all disabilities, but autism was always sort of just my little secret love, and not a secret at all, actually. So I started a program. I was at San Manuel State for a few years, and I started a program. Let me go back a little bit. I recognized that a lot of our students with autism weren't staying. They would come. They would enroll. I would get them on my, you know, roster or my list, and then they'd be gone, and I would be like, what's going on here? So I looked into it, and I realized that they just weren't getting the support that they need. They were getting support. Don't get me wrong. It was just might not have been what they needed. So I started a whole program. I wrote a manual.
That's why great. Not?
I created a manual. I called the group Full Spectrum Support. And I started with a group of four, just sort of as a first group to see how it would go. And it was amazing. By second semester, I had 8 students. Third semester, I had 20 students. It just grew and grew and grew. So I created a manual so that it could be duplicated wherever. I was like, here, just take copies. Just do it. Like, I don't care. Like, it's not about anything except helping these students. So. What I recognized was I had all this great stuff, Adam. I did all this research and I was like, this day we're going to talk about this. And then when I went in, I was like, these guys just need to socialize. Like, they just want. So I would still incorporate some of that within it, but we would play games. We would talk about movies. We would talk about their interests. And then I started doing faculty workshops. Like, here's how to recognize autism. Here's how to connect. Here's what to do. Because we had one situation where I get called into the dean's office and, you know, the teacher's all riled up and I was like, explain to me what happened. Cause I know there's always something that somebody's missing. And, the teacher's like, we were about to start this, you know, thing. And I was going to call on a student to do whatever. And I walked up to him and he put his hand up and he said, don't start with me.
No.
So immediately she got, you know, defensive. And this is where ego comes in. You know, all about
is that her thinking that like, I'm the teacher. I know that kind of idea.
Yeah. It was sort of just a, why is he being so rude? He just put his hand up to me and said, don't start with me. So I looked at him knowing this kid, like, this isn't a thing. And, or I don't know, something's missing or whatever. And he just looked at me and said, I just didn't want to be the first one to go. So he was saying, don't start with me, meaning I don't want to be the first person. So this whole,
and she took it as
massive,
this rude thing.
Yep. And it escalated into something that it just didn't need to be. So if she had an understanding about autism and how literal they traditionally are, she would have known there wasn't sarcasm involved at all. It's just, you know, the way it was. So once we got that all settled, I was like, oh yeah, we need training up in here. So I started doing faculty training, which was really fun and really exciting to do and helpful. So it made the professors comfortable enough with me where if there was an issue going on, they would contact me before they would, you know, act in a way that might not be great for the students. So, so then I got selected to be on a panel of, there was, 12 to 15 of us from all over the state of Florida. And we created the curriculum to teach first responders how to recognize and respond to people with autism.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Man, Robin.
I know. Oh. You had no idea the depths of Robin.
Yes. this is what I like doing the podcast, why I never preface. What are we talking about?
Yeah.
What do we go into? Because I like to learn on real, like in yeah. real time. You know, of what we're talking about, because then it looks like I'm throwing up softballs for questions. You know what I mean? Wow. So wrote an entire manual.
We did. We wrote the curriculum. Yes.
Yeah.
So that other people can take that curriculum and teach first responders all over how to respond, how to recognize. That's the first piece. And then respond.
Can people get that still?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it should be out there, I'd assume. I've never actually seen the finishing product of what we created, but we were like in this like think tank for just 3 days straight. We did nothing but from, you know, 9 to 5, just sit there together. We had retired police officers. We had acted police and firefighters. We had people in the field like myself. It was incredible.
Man, how many lives that possibly has been able to touch?
I don't know.
That's really neat.
And hopefully continually, you know, like what?
No, it will keep going. Yeah. I mean, you know, some practitioners, researchers, right? They put something together. Then it's like, all right, pay me to get the manual right. or something like that.
And you know
what?
That. This entire group is all on a voluntary basis.
Mm. I like how you stretch it out to first responders, police officers, et cetera, right? Because yeah. at first, I'm not thinking about that, right? And from a mental health standpoint, I kind of do. A lot of police officers are not trained in psychology at all.
My daughter is 22 now, and she drives. She's very high functioning. She has a full-time job. So I have instructed her, if you ever get pulled over, the first words out of your mouth have to be, I have autism. Mm-hmm. Because I want them to understand why she may not be looking them in the eye, or why her voice may sound different, or why if they ask her to do something, she might not respond for a couple of seconds because she needs to process, or she's so, you know, scared. Well, we all get scared, right? Imagine having on top of that the anxiety already.
Yeah.
So I said, don't say anything else until you look at them and say, I have autism.
Man, so yeah, pointing that out was something I certainly wanted to do, because you don't think about that. You know, from a mental health standpoint, you do that. That poor guy that was mentally ill and got shot just in the street reaching for something. I mean, mm-hmm.
An autistic young man who was shot. He had like a toy truck in his hand. And
yeah.
Because, you know, they have some sort of self-stimulation or self-stimming was what we call it. Behavior, he probably reached out to, you know, to soothe himself, and he got shot.
Yeah, I mean, and it's hard, right? Because I personally think one of the hardest jobs on the planet is to be a cop.
Oh, I'm not blaming police officers at all. I hope it doesn't sound like that.
Well, I'll say there's some shitty ones out there.
Well, there's shitty everything. Yeah. There's shitty people who work with autistic people. You
right,
know?
Right. I mean, there's the quick draw McGraw types, and yeah. Those are there. But,
right, but that's not where I'm going with that at
yeah,
all. No,
sure.
I'm so grateful for what they do every day, and I can't imagine they have to be on such heightened alert.
I couldn't.
That's why we got to help each other.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why bringing them in, I think, is important on a lot of levels, and possibly even throwing a curriculum at them that incorporates mm-hmm. autism as mandatory training.
Yes, it is now.
They may add some mental health training, et cetera, along the way. I don't know. It's been about 5 years since I...
And that's what they need to recognize the difference of, because somebody with schizophrenia may at first look similar to somebody with autism, so we need to really... decipher that before we make a decision on how we're going to approach, because they're going to respond differently.
Yeah. And a lot of people tend to misconstrue that schizophrenics are violent. It's actually the opposite.
Oh yeah.
Most are really docile.
Mm-hmm.
And will listen to just about anything somebody's telling them.
And that's it. It's the same kind of thing. We have to get into their world instead of trying to bring them into ours. Cause like I said, I've worked with people with all disabilities. So I had a student with schizophrenia who was having an issue at school. And so they called me because the officer was like, I don't know what to do. So all I did was make sure she was with us. So I walked in and I said, oh, hey, look, I think there's new chairs in this room. Hey, so-and-so, what do you think of these chairs? They're awesome. And she went from screaming to looking at the chairs. And then she's like, oh, I don't know. I'm like, well, what's the difference between the last one? I can't even remember what the last ones look like. So I brought her into the room. I brought her back to us. And it took, you know, a good 20 minutes for us to completely calm down. But it, you know, she went from here to here instantly, and we just started talking about things that I knew she was interested in, and we got things situated, and the officer afterwards was like, I've never seen anything like that. I'm like, do you see how easy it was when you know what to do? Because I could have gotten just as escalated as she was, or I could have gotten aggressive or in her space, but instead I tried to just get into her head and get her to where we were, and... Yeah.
Yeah. There's so much more training. And again, I don't think I said it enough that, you know, my hat's off to police officers. It's a job I
Absolutely.
Couldn't do. Hard. You're walking around, your life's in danger, and you think it's a regular, you know, traffic stop or something. So, you know, shout out to those that do it well, despite the pressures from that side.
Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah. When I was working, Leo, mentor, I talk about all the time on the podcast. We were working inpatient facility. We had a res level 2 where we had detox. Not quite where you'd bring someone to Baker Act, but, if somebody was literally coming off withdrawing or something, and they tend to get pretty violent sometimes when that's happening. And man, he's not this big intimidating guy whatsoever, right? He's got a really chill demeanor. And he was telling me about if someone's raging, right, something like that, to actually meet them near the rage.
Okay.
That, and he would say, don't come in with talking all calm if they're screaming and yelling, the mental health direction or addiction withdrawal type violence, knowing not on the spectrum, right? Knowing it's not schizophrenia. We know the diagnosis. But so as and walking in, and I watched this guy walk into a room with a massive man, a very massive, intimidating man, who was rather upset with a phone in his hand as a weapon and was like saying, come in and get me. And no one would. And Leo goes in there, but goes in there almost irate as he is, but on his team. He's going in like, what are they doing to you?
I can't believe this.
Yeah. And just like, what are they doing to you? This is, and then, and he would slowly,
and, to bring him with him.
And walk him right down. And I was,
that's cool.
I was like, wow, man. Cause he always would jump in like that because it wouldn't be long before the cops get called. And many times they got called early and, you know, they'd come in there and do their thing, knee on the, you know, back of the neck and down and handcuffed up. And we hated seeing patients go through that. And he'd be jumping in like, I got this one.
Yeah.
Quick story.
Yeah. You've got one of those?
Yeah.
Awesome.
As a intern, just getting into it, I had witnessed Leo do this once. And there was a gentleman on the back porch smoke area, right, who had gotten to this level, and big ex-biker guy, and me and my ego go, I'll go get him.
Oh Lord.
There was about 5 seconds of conversation before he swung at me, literally swung, and I ducked and whoosh, and missed. I backpedaled, came back inside, I'm like, I quit.
I done.
Like, yeah. And oddly enough, is after I finished the year interning, and they actually hired me before I graduated, put me on as a full-time therapist. The first patient that I had was that guy. Yeah. I looked at the patient and I went, look at my caseload. I can't believe it. And actually,
did he remember you?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh yeah. And turns out, after he left some treatment with at the facility myself, never relapsed again.
Oh,
turned his life around.
Wonderful.
Went through some major stuff, and he and I are in contact on Facebook. So I see him.
That's awesome.
Yeah, little so the same guy tried to take my head off. You know what I mean? Hey. Kind of the first time, verbally at least, right? And I'm just like, good God. And the irony of that, I was like, wow, I'll take it.
But when you do what you do for so long, in your case and in my case, you just know that it's there's typically no malintent. They don't want to hurt us. They just are hurting, and they need help in whatever way, you know, we can offer it.
Yeah. How did you cope with the burnout in that industry?
It's funny, you know, the burnout is usually about 5 years, and yeah. I lasted 26, 27 years. So,
wow.
And I just followed what I could handle, like I said. So if I couldn't do the physical stuff anymore, I wanted to do, you know, so I grew with it, and I wound up working with college students, which is, you know, was a beautiful thing. And then I decided that, I was ready to continue to spread awareness, which is what I do, Adam, on my show. Should we talk about my show?
Look at how we... Oh, man.
Did you love that?
Wonderful
if
segue.
If I didn't point out the segue, we could have just had a good segue there, but...
As if you don't host your own show. Can you tell people? Can you tell how she just smoothed right into there?
Right in there.
Well done.
So I couldn't give up on people with disabilities. That's my world. That's what I love. That's what I do, and I have a lot of experience, so... I decided that I wanted to continue to spread awareness, but how can I do this in a way that's suiting my life now? And about 12, 13 years ago, I guess now, gosh, I was diagnosed with celiac disease, which means I cannot eat gluten at all in any capacity, not even any cross-contamination, nothing. I don't go to restaurants unless they're 100% gluten-free, which is rare. Yeah. But we do have a couple now in Central Florida, which is nice.
I think you told me two.
Yeah, Bolle and Fresh Kitchen. I'm going to do a shout out right now because they're both really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can eat out now. It's so exciting.
Oh.
Because usually I don't eat from anywhere but my own kitchen.
Yeah.
Just to stay safe. And when I was trying different things, it was like anything you got that was a baked good was just, you had two options back then. It either tasted like cardboard or Play-Doh. And, you know,
I've tasted Play-Doh.
Yeah.
For a while when I was a kid.
You know,
when
you're looking for a dessert, it's not so great.
Yeah, glue, Play-Doh, we did the whole thing.
And I loved to bake, so I was like, I am going to figure this out. So I worked for years to perfect these great gluten-free recipes. And now they have restaurants or places that sell gluten-free desserts, but they're very, very expensive. So I was like, I want people to be able to do this at home. So that's where the baking show came from.
That was Bake With Me?
It's called Bake With Me.
Yeah.
And you can find it on Facebook under Bake With Me Gluten Free on YouTube. Bake With Me Gluten Free.
Can I back up?
Yeah.
What were some symptoms, signs that you were experiencing the celiac?
So
how does that manifest?
Right.
You know,
so it's an autoimmune disease.
Okay.
So like any other autoimmune disease, trauma can cause it to exacerbate the symptoms.
Wow.
So I've really had stomach issues my whole life, but nothing as bad as what it started getting. If you really want to get into it, I've had a crazy world.
Yeah.
My first husband was killed in a car accident caused by a drunk driver. So, I was 30 and, our kids were 3, 5, and 8 at the time.
Oh my God.
So needless to say, trauma.
That's traumatic. Yeah.
And my symptoms started getting worse. I couldn't keep anything down. And at first I thought it was grief or emotion or what have you. Then I dropped down to about 118 pounds, and I'm 5'6", so it really just wasn't, and my body's just bigger anyway, so it was not healthy. I felt like I was in my 90s. There were times where I couldn't get out of the bed, so.
Oh, major fatigue.
I was like writing my kids, I really thought they were going to lose both their parents. It was not good. I was going to doctors, and at the time, celiac disease was not really a thing that was known too well. So they weren't testing me for it, and I was getting all of these other tests done, and everything was negative. And so my general practitioner, I'll never forget this, looked at me and said, you know, you're a perfectly healthy woman. I think it's time to see a therapist.
Oh, my God. Did the redirect.
And my chest got tight, and I got so upset. I was like, if you know me at all, I have this huge love for life. I'm sick. I don't know what's wrong. Help me. So she obviously couldn't. So I left and I got online. I want to say it was dial up back then. I don't even know. It was like, you know, you waiting.
So then, just to catch up. So inability to really eat or hold anything down or want to eat.
It was, so I've had children, so I can tell you the pain was comparable to being like,
oh my God,
6-7 centimeters dilated. Like it was excruciating pain doubled over. Like I've had some celiacs now that I know so many people, have told me that they go to the hospital. They've gone, you know, to the emergency room because it's so bad. And I have a pretty high tolerance for pain. So I think I was just that able to tolerate it, even though as nobody, you don't ever want anyone to go through that. My thighs would shake. I'd, you know, you'd expel everything that was inside you, whichever way it wanted to come out. Every time you ate. So like, you just were like, I don't even want to eat.
Yeah. You become trauma just eating and eventually
I got online and I just started putting in my symptoms and all this stuff was coming up, all the stuff that I had been tested for, and then all of a sudden I see celiac disease and I was like, well, haven't seen that one before, let's click on that. And I clicked on that, and as I'm reading it, I'm like, oh wait, my body does that. Oh wait, this happens to me. So I took the diagnosis to another doctor and I said, I think this is what I have. So then they tested me for it. And my doctor actually said, because, you know, I like to do everything all the way, Adam. I don't do anything half-assed. Like,
yeah,
I do
noticed
it
charts
day.
And graphs, kids. I got
so,
you.
Right. So she said to me after she's got my chart, she goes, I think you have the most severe case of celiac I've ever
Holy
seen.
Shit.
And I had done so much damage to my small intestines that I was not absorbing any nutrients. So when I felt like I was dying, I in fact was.
Holy shit. And you got doctors going, you need therapy.
Yep.
Man, you see that a lot. What did they originally think was wrong with you? What was the first thing that...
Well, grief.
Okay,
right?
Sure. Yeah.
You can't get away from that. And then IBS, colitis, I don't even know, to be honest with you. Like, esophageal stuff, like everything. They tested for everything, and it just...
And nothing.
Nothing.
Oh, my gosh. That's so often we have to be diligent, and if we don't feel right...
Well, now I think that it's... fairly standard. Unfortunately, the blood test for celiac disease is not very accurate. So there are, if it tests positive, it's like a pregnancy test. If it tests positive, you have celiac disease. But if it tests negative, that doesn't mean you don't. Mm. It's crazy. So they have to do a biopsy to really test for sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So they go and do the biopsy. Then you got the definite.
Yep. That's a definitive answer.
Oh, it's got to be somewhat of a scary point and a relief to know finally what it
is.
Oh,
when I had a diagnosis, I about threw a party. Like, and people are like, oh, I'm so sorry. No, don't be sorry. This is great news. Now I know, again, now I know how to treat it. Just like I've said about having any diagnosis. To me, it's not a shameful thing. It's not a negative thing. It's freaking awesome because now I can do my research. Now I can figure out how to get healthy. And I did. And it took about a year and a half for my intestines to heal fully.
Oh my God.
So I still got sporadically sick here and there. Like I knew everywhere I went, Publix, Kohl's, Target, where their bathroom was. Like I would guide everything by how long it took me to get there because I didn't know if I'd be able to make it in between.
Yeah. I can see him going, all right, she's got OCD, she's got PTSD, she has severe anxiety.
Oh, honey, I have it all now because, and even to this day.
Well, I meant before the diagnosis.
Oh, before. Absolutely,
yeah, I can see it going, oh, okay, I think you need to see.
But I have behaviors now that I never had before. So there's certain brands that you automatically know are gluten-free because you've been using them for so long, but I'm like a label checker now. And because I get so violently
ill. Yeah, I was going to say. I think I'd be reading everything too. Yeah.
So I have, and I'm going to admit this here today. I don't do it as often anymore, but I have thrown packages out and I've had to, before I take a bite, go back. I've taken it out of the garbage. I had to see it again. Sure. I had to read gluten-free or read the label before I would eat.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I mean, I would. I have, yeah, no issue there. That's not an OCD. That's I don't want to feel like I'm dying again.
It doesn't feel very healthy when you're digging in the garbage, though.
Yeah. So what are some of the foods that, you typically stay away from? And maybe for those that don't know, right, we hear gluten all the time, right? What is gluten?
Gluten is a protein that's found in wheat, rye, and barley, and sometimes even oats. So if your oats are grown in the same fields as wheat, then there's cross-contamination. If you have oats that are grown all on their own in fields of their own, they can be certified gluten-free oats. So you have to even be careful there. All of those things, especially wheat, are cheap fillers. So they use them in everything. Not just people think gluten, they think, oh, it's bread, pasta.
Right.
Everything. Your sauces, your, you know, anything that you could possibly eat.
Like palm oil almost. It's in everything. It's in plastic. It's in food. It's in everything. So they use that as a cheap. Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. And they say, because I've done a lot of research on this as well, and I don't know if it's true or not, but they say the reason why celiac is becoming more prevalent is the way we used to process wheat, because we didn't have as much of a need for it back then. They would pull it. They'd soak it for a week. They would go through this whole process. And they said if we go back to now, they just yank it, shred it, go, like just give it up. They said if we go back to the old way of processing wheat, that we wouldn't have as much of an issue. And also, of course, the pesticides and the, we're not even going to get into that, but.
Why not?
How much time we got, Adam?
I don't time the show, so it's whatever. How much time you got?
That's right. it's really pretty much in everything. It's in everything.
Well, it seems more and more the industrial farming age, as much as, you know, it's necessary to feed the amounts of people that we have. Right. Unfortunately, that's one of many issues that this is causing.
Yeah.
Factory farming, I mean, on and on. We typically eat, you know, pasture raised, right?
Okay.
I mean, there's so many tricks. Oh, my God. I can't remember. I was reading the Purdue Farms new chicken thing that came out. Oh, linked to family farms or something like that.
Hmm.
And, you know, the green packaging. And so linked to family farms or something like that. And I'm like,
what does that even mean?
Right. Purdue is a family farm. So, I mean, what are we talking about here? Right. And the links that they will go to try to, I mean, we all know the idea of natural when that first came out. Everything's natural, mm-hmm. and we know that that's automatic.
Well, so is opium, but we're not. Sorry.
That's true. All natural opium. Man, you open up like 9 rows. I was like, well, and why we're in Afghanistan, actually, right? No. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Oops.
But yeah, the what food has become and what it used to be is barely even food anymore. So you have to
barely even food, and that's the thing that I do want to point out, that if you want gluten free foods, you're going to go more natural. Your fruits and your vegetables, those are all naturally gluten free. I still wash them. I still scrub them because you don't know. Even when I go to like Publix and if I want some fish, they put them in the same things. If you see, they'll do like crab cakes and it's all breaded, and then next to it is sitting the shrimp that I want.
Oh, wow. Right? Yeah. So that's sensitive to you.
Absolutely.
So even if the food is next to a food in the case.
When I was still learning, I went to a restaurant and which servers, you know, don't understand. And it took me years to perfect it. So I can't possibly expect anyone to understand. So it's not against anyone when I say this. They made sure my food was gluten free, and then they must have used like a knife that they had cut something else, and then they cut my food. Violently ill. Within 20 minutes, I was violently ill.
That's all it takes. Some people are that way, right, with peanuts or shellfish.
Right.
Yeah, we went to sit down and eat some sushi the other day, and after the forewarning and signing your
life away,
I was like, I don't think I want to eat here anymore. I'm a little nervous.
Right.
I mean,
this
literally
is not the way
the
I want to go today.
Yeah, literally X the box off. Are you sure you don't have any allergies?
Wow.
And I'm like, Mike, all right, I guess. Should I be eating this?
And I'm glad you brought that up, because people with autoimmune diseases should not eat raw food. You can eat raw vegetables and stuff, but raw fish, I should say, or raw.
Like tuna or sushi.
Right. There's something in our makeup, I guess, of our bodies that cannot tolerate it. And I found that out the hard way. Because I love it. I love tuna.
So
I love
you got,
sushi.
Yeah.
But I make it at home now, just not raw.
Wow. So I was going to say, that's where I was leading to, is with so many limited options out there, it seems like the best way to do it is to just go on your own,
Hence, bake with me. I wanted people to be able to do this on their own, and they're delicious. My baked goods are so good, a little too good. So when I decided to do bake with me, thank you for leading back to that. I was like, I can't
see
not.
That? See,
I love it. You're good.
Away.
It's like you have your own show. I could not give up disabilities. So I thought, how can I incorporate? Because, you know, food and disabilities goes, you know, hand in hand.
Yeah.
Not really.
Yeah,
so I decided to invite a guest with a disability each episode. So while we're baking, not only do you get to learn this delicious gluten-free recipe, which, by the way, if you can eat gluten, just use regular flour and make the same recipe. It'll turn out great. People can learn about a certain diagnosis, and they talk about their successes and their challenges and all that great stuff. So you get to learn two things when you watch Bake With Me.
What a great show.
It is a great show. I love it.
Yeah, and you were it's filmed at Full Sail, right?
It's filmed at Full Sail University. Yes, they are amazing. They helped me out so much. The set that we had been using, because there are people that actually pay for their shows. Oh, wait, I shouldn't say that. I pay for mine.
Yeah, if anybody out there, by the way, would like to sponsor or make sure that, Bake With Me
stays on
and keeps going, please reach out to Robin and, you know, help. If you're out there and go through celiac and or something like that, please reach out and get the show back going with a full studio or something, yeah?
Yeah, we're working on it.
You were talking about building one, right?
My director is amazing. He just believes in my mission. He volunteers his time. Thank you, Rob Toscani. Anyway, so he found an area that is not being used at Full Sail so that we would be able to build our set. So I'm pricing things out now. It looks like we can probably do it for under a few grand. I'm trying to make that happen.
Listen, business sponsor people.
Yes, I will mention you on the show constantly. I will thank you
profusely. A few grand and you're getting a constant sponsor of a show like this that's bringing disabilities to light, educating people, a background yes. like Robin's, and helping people learn how to eat healthy with celiac disease. You're an idiot. Title company, real estate company, people that are blowing thousands
Lowe's,
and thousands.
Home Depot.
Right. Anybody that's in that realm. You,
yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
Now that I've called the morons for not.
Yes. Thanks. I'm sure they're going to get right on that.
He calls an idiot. We're calling her. Yeah.
The beautiful thing that I didn't think would happen was how it affects my guests. Like, I always thought, like, oh, this is going to be so great. People who see it can relate to it or this and that and this and that. And it's great for them to come on. But I had one of my guests, ran into her a few weeks ago. We were at the same event. And this was a nice, probably about 15, 20 people at the event. And so at the end, we kind of just all got together and everybody was telling, you know, what was going on with them and what was whatever. And so she was like, you know, can I get everyone's attention? She's like, I just want to say, while I have this opportunity, I just want to thank Robin for letting me be a guest on her show. And I was like, what? Like,
what was her disability?
Polio.
Holy shit.
I know. I actually said, holy, oh, polio.
Whoa, like,
so dumb.
Wow.
But it, like, you just don't talk about it anymore.
Sure.
You don't hear about it.
So you're starting to hear a little bit now with the vaccine issue thing happening. And it's a kid or two popping up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did six roads open up for you right there real quick?
Yeah. Yeah. See that? I can't.
Reel it in.
So she said to everyone, and she said to me that being on my show changed her life. Mm. And like my eyes welled up, and she said she never talked about her disability because it just wasn't a thing, you know. Back in the day, you don't talk about stuff like that. You just don't, you know, and for her to express it and open up, and her friends were all super engaged and were, you know, commenting and complimenting her and telling her how brave she was.
Please don't let me be rude. Just keep.
No, you just keep texting. It's okay. I'm going to talk to everybody out there.
No, I'm
no, just kidding.
I get paranoid. Okay. If you can imagine.
And about it really, not working.
Right. I really love the show. Kids are like, keep going. So I'm like, I want to make sure like this is doing it right. Usually I could just check it live. Yes.
Is it
go working? On? Yes.
Yes. It was such a dramatic moment too, Adam.
Yeah.
So she was very grateful. She said it changed her life. She said she has more confidence now, and it was just such a beautiful moment. And I was like, this is exactly why I'm doing what I'm doing, right? I've had some beautiful responses. We did our very first episode. It was with my daughter. I have a lot of diagnoses in my family. my daughter has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which we can talk about later.
No, you have to educate me.
So Ehlers-Danlos is, have you ever seen people who are super flexible? And mm-hmm. It actually messes with their connective tissue. And she, you know, is in pain a lot. And she's capable of doing a lot because it's not severe for her. But there are kids who have Ehlers-Danlos that it's very severe and it's hard for them to do certain movements, and they're super bendy, so they like to do it, right? They'll do the back bends, they'll do whatever, but the doctor's like, but you shouldn't do it just because your body can do it.
Yeah.
When she was younger, she wanted to be a cheerleader and she was strong, so she was a base, and the doctor said, I don't have a problem letting you do this, but you are bendy. So if somebody steps their foot in the wrong place, your body's going to bend with it, because it can, but then it's going to just break because it can't hold that type of weight. So as long as you're careful, you
is
know.
Is it a thing with joints, ligaments, or muscles?
It's more about the connective tissue. I don't really know medically, like,
sure,
more,
sure.
more than that. But yes, her joints definitely do swell and hurt, you know, more often. She was a server for an Italian restaurant for several years, and she was just in pain all the time. I was like, baby, you have to find another job. But she was making so much money and she was doing so well, and they loved her there. So she stayed with it. But I'm happy to say that she has found a job that is not as physically straining. So she's hopefully not going to be in as much pain. But anyway, so she was on my first episode because naturally, why not have you know, one of your kids? And I had a mom email me and say, you know, thank you so much for the show. She said, my daughter has Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. We sat on the couch and we watched it together, and she hit me on the couch and she said, Mom, she's just like me, you know? And I was like,
oh, that's that social connection, learning that there's people like us. You don't feel so alone. You're saving serious mental health issues down the line by doing that.
Yeah.
Because go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, people watching the show who don't have any of these things can look at it and say, oh, this is what that looks like, right? Especially with the autism. I had a young man with autism on the show. So I feel like if it does so much as, like, if you're standing in the grocery store and you happen to be standing next to somebody who might be look like the kid that you just saw and whatever, then you'll go, oh, okay, he's not being obnoxious, or he's not being whatever. He might not be looking me in the eyes, but maybe it's because he has something, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just building some compassion that way in the earth is sort of some recognizing. You and I talked about awareness a little bit on my show. Yeah. Oh, my other show.
Yeah. The other show, right?
The other show.
Chat with me.
We talked about awareness, and you're like, I'm sick of it. We're aware. And the thing is that we're not always aware. And if
I wasn't aware of the autoimmune disorder you just talked about.
Ehlers-Danlos,
I knew celiac, but the details of it were not.
Right.
Yeah, sure.
Right. So when it's one thing to be aware, and awareness is great, but now we have to switch from awareness to understanding.
Mm.
Right? Because it's one thing, okay, we're aware. Like, I know it's there, but how about let's understand it? Because if we understand it, then that's where the true compassion and empathy is going to come in.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I used that for a shock and awe point, is to kind of go, can we do something, please? Like, we're aware. All right.
We're aware now.
Can we
now
do
what?
Something to help people with what's going on here? Yeah. I tend to do that shock and awe thing.
So I want understanding months instead of awareness months.
Yeah. And I want do something months.
Active months.
Mental health, do something.
Yeah.
You know? And, part of what your show also is doing by the Bake With Me show, mm-hmm. Well, you do it with Chat With Me, too. You have all types of individuals that come on there. Is that connection that people get when they see, okay, I'm not alone, right? There's people out there. The information, right? They become competent. With that competent, we can become a little more confident in what we're doing that can push us to be enthusiastic back in our lives, to treat our diagnosis, right? To know what it is. And more importantly, become connected again. I think highly underrated in mental health and addiction, and I would say autoimmune disorders, et cetera, is generally the isolation and the lack of connectivity.
Yes.
Dr. Gabor Maté talks a little bit about it. I disagree with him on a few points, right? That's what his theorists do, but points out the importance of, you know, connectivity in human beings and the need for that.
Yeah.
And I'm a heavy facilitator of that in the facility that I work at. It is pushing the idea of reconnecting socially in constructive places, right? But your show is essentially doing that for those, like the one that points out and goes, hey, oh, that's what I'm dealing with. And then they reach out to somebody, and so many times you'll see somebody that, like the lady on your show, right, that complimented you for what you did for,
mm-hmm.
more than likely, she may create a show or a chat room or a group.
Or a support group of some sort, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You need a new show called, like, Ripples. Because you have Ripples for 30 years.
I need another show like I need.
Well, just sum it up and call it Ripples. And sometimes you bake, sometimes you have people on. Because you have created Ripples over the last 30 years, Robin, mm-hmm. that God knows how many people, you know, that's rippled out to touch. I mean, because it eludes me that one person that is inspired and or makes changes equals seven at least within and then you got, there's a thing that you can look up, right?
It's
where
beautiful.
If you touch one by averages, that one will touch seven others, that seven will touch seven others, and you kind of walk it all back. I mean, I'd hate to use the STD model, right?
Yeah, could we not? In relation to my show?
Right. You know, and they're drawing it, and they're like, if this person's been with three people, then they've been with three people, then you're like, oh my God.
So funny. It's thinking about that type of correlation, it's so funny when I do write out sometimes like, oh, we're making apple cake and we're talking about polio. Like, this is this apple cake cosplay? No, no, no.
Well, what a good
sometimes
thing.
Sometimes it's hard because it doesn't, on paper, it doesn't look like it fits, but it's such a beautiful thing when it happens. And even the crew that comes in, a lot of the crew are students because it's at Full Sail.
Yeah.
And they feel, it's so great to see these young people so inspired by it, and they feel so connected. They're like, when are you filming next? I want to be back. Students who have graduated that come back just to help out on the show because they support it and love the mission so much.
Yeah, I certainly do. And I think it's great to be doing so. Not only are you helping with the celiac disease by cooking what you're cooking, or whatever you're doing, it's a way to talk about some more serious issues in people's lives, mm-hmm. And what's affecting them over an apple pie.
On a very casual level, and to see people that it's okay to ask questions. Like, I've always been curious, raised my children the same way. Don't stare at the guy in the wheelchair. If you want to talk to him, ask him what's going on, and if he minds sharing with you, hey, let's figure it out together. He could say no, and that's fine. We walk away, but... it's better to try to communicate with somebody. So when I'm standing there in the kitchen and I'm asking somebody, oh, how did that make you feel? Oh, did you get bullied when you were in high school? People stay away from that stuff. They don't want, they don't want to rock that boat. I want to rock that boat. I want to know what's going on inside you so that you can let that out and we can talk about it. And we don't have to make a big deal about it. It just is what it is. So let's address it and then we can move forward with it.
Yeah, the behavioral analyst in you, the helper in
you. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, the pulling it out of them. I mean, I like the idea of ripples, by the way, because
I like that too.
you're Robin's ripples, right? Just getting out there and changing people's lives, even if just touching it a little bit with some information.
But it's not about me at all. It's about them and once they see how incredible they are and how capable they are, and that's what I want people to see. Yeah, they've got a disability, but look, they're standing here. They're talking to us. They're baking. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't want people to be so afraid of it anymore or so tucked away anymore. It's just, let's let it all out. Like, let your freak flag fly.
Easy now, people. All right.
I'm just kidding.
I tend to do that in treatment facilities that I work in, or the one I'm in now. Is I love revealing to people how much wisdom they actually have. A lot of times you're in that treatment facility dealing with addiction or mental health issues. We're masters of self-criticism, mm-hmm. I'll create the 7-year-old kid who's come to you for advice and he's dealing with A, B, and C. What do you tell him? And it's amazing how fast they're like, oh, look, you need to da 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 da. They come right with it, right? They come right from the wisdom and truth, right? Or I'll turn around and say, what are some coping skills he could do or use? Alternatives, right? Listen, I'll turn around. I'm like, why are you in here? Right? And they get that smile. I'm like, I told you. You know what to do.
Yeah.
You know exactly what to do. It's not, you're not weak as you think you are. You have the wisdom. You have the tools. It's another thing I learned from Leo, my mentor there in therapy is looking at somebody and saying, look, when in doubt, do what you would advise. Mm-hmm. Think of someone you love most. And when your emotions, he's about coming from your own truth to make decisions, not emotion. And we make terrible emotional decisions most of the time. And if you're trying to make better decisions in your life, it's trying to remove the emotion from it.
Yeah.
And he gives two things to do is the top five perspective, which is if I was dying in 5 days, would this be a top five? Immediate perspective. And then if you don't know what to do, think about, your kids or somebody you love most. And what would you advise? And it's whatever you advise them right there, that's your truth. Do that before the emotion comes back and being able to cut through those. And it's amazing when you treat people like people and not patients.
Right.
At places.
Or their diagnosis.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
I refuse to allow anybody in my groups or individually to say that I am anything. I am depressed. I am bipolar. I was like, well, you don't say I am headache.
Right.
I am not cancer. Right. It's making that dialogue, that shift in dialogue if I'm being affected by.
Right.
I am not my diagnosis.
That's how I've always addressed it as well. You don't say, and I hate this when they do it, and then an autistic child. No, he's a child with autism. Mm. So, you always put the person first in how you say it.
Yeah, and some people go, that's semantics. I'm like, over time, it is not.
That's correct.
Yeah, over time, we begin to believe what we reinforce with our own dialogue over and over and over. I'm depressed. I'm an addict. This is why I don't do the I'm an addict thing.
Yeah. They're so different. We can, by textbook, we can say what the diagnosis might look like. But, there's a saying in autism that once you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism because they're so different. So people look at the spectrum as very linear because when you think of a spectrum, you think of one line. But I think of a recording console. You know, there's all these knobs that go up and down. So maybe socialization could be down here, but then math could be like all the way up here. And, you know, receptive skills are here and, you know, expressive skills are here. So it's all over the place and every one of them is different. So.
I like that. We're like mixing boards.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I have a similar thing is I think about video games and you're picking your character in the video game and they have a lot of power, but they have slow speed. They have a lot of agility, some stamina. You know, I kind of look at individuals.
We need to brainstorm together.
Right. I'm kind of like this is video games and you pick the one, you know, you try to get the one with all of it kind of even, you know, like where we're trying to push ourselves. And I it's really good. Actually, I told you I've recently got back in the therapist chair. I was out of the game for a while, fighting the powers that be.
really, did you win?
we're still swinging.
I
do remember, you know, in 2013, I started the show and, I was really angry.
Yeah, that's crazy. You've had this a long time.
Yeah. I was angry, right? The rampage, cognitive rampage, right? I was pissed. And early shows, I was scared. I was mad. Mm-hmm. And
well, you probably should have been.
Yeah. I was pissed. And, you know, As I got into it further, right, and I think it was last year, 2018, maybe 2017, I can't remember. You know, we were pulling together really to fight what I was calling chemical incarceration, right? It was the idea of over-prescribing, things like that, right? And, you know, backing out, like I said earlier, more now, it's more of the system itself, right, as opposed to the individuals trying to work within the system, even though there are corrupt ones. Trying to bring light of, and I use quotes on purpose, opiate epidemic, because there's some issues with that too, because people that really need opiates can't get them when there really is no cure for what they're doing, right? And some do overprescribe. So there's a thousand other shows, people. Go listen to that. but I do remember Patricia and I were laying in bed. We were watching Last Week and Tonight with John Oliver. And the entire segment of the show was about this topic. And the first thing I did is I went, woo!
Yes.
I was like, it's out there. You know, when that show covers it, and I started hearing it more and more and more. There were, you know, one guy who's up for me is, you know, just on the front lines and has been for 20 years is Dr. Stanton Peale. He has been just unheard and, you know, really muffled over his career. I don't know, 12, 13 books at least on issues with AA, how we're treating people with addiction, and, you know, just leads up to it. But it's pretty amazing. And so, but when I saw it start to spread, you know, and I got that opportunity to be on Joe Rogan and say what I said, I do have a lot of podcast regret for that show. Yes. I generalized a lot of things.
Have you done an anti-podcast?
Yeah, I kind of went back.
Like, but you go back and correct all the things you wanted to.
Yeah, I generalized. It's out there now. You know, I couldn't take it back. I generalized some things, focused on a couple of things. And it was difficult because I had Nick DiPaolo, a great comedian in the room, a now-known right-wing comedian, right, which made it rough, and Joe himself. And even Brian Redband was in the room for a little bit. So I got three hilarious dudes in a room, and I'm trying to talk about that, and I wasn't doing comedy at the time either.
Okay.
And it's the first podcast I ever did.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, mine was just a little Ustream show with like six people, you know, when I started it. And so so being there, it was difficult to talk about, and then also trying to find jokes in what I was saying. So it was kind of like, oh, shit. You know, I cringe sometimes when I go back and listen to them. Oh, aww. Jesus Christ. You know, they fired me from both of my therapist jobs within 24 hours. After being on that show,
I did not know that.
They did. They fired me.
Wow.
Both therapist positions when I got off the show. And that's when I went, fine.
Yeah.
All right.
I'll show you.
We're going hard now. I was like, all right. But yeah. Enough about me. Imagine that. I curbed it back to myself.
I learned some of this, Adam, when you were a guest on my show.
Yes. Chat with Me can be heard on Facebook and seen there and shortly on iTunes and Stitcher.
Sure, Adam.
Yeah, we will help you get that to a full-on podcast.
That'd be great. Yeah, so once I had the platform of Bake With Me and I realized that it was making a difference, I didn't even care if it was in two lives, you know? That's what I say. If I affect one life, a million lives, whatever, as long as I'm affecting lives, I was like, there are so many other things I want to spread awareness on. And again, it's about recognizing who people are. You know, everyone has a story, everyone. And if we sit and listen, if we choose to listen, then we could change everything, right? Because we'll know where they're coming from. That's another thing I want to talk about in just a minute. But yes, Chat With Me is on Facebook. It's also on YouTube, but I really just plug it on Facebook. You just look up Chat With Me and you'll see my mug, not this mug, but like my coffee mug. And and it's great. I just really have everyone and anyone who wants to come share a story. I say I have ordinary people with extraordinary stories. And
is that the tagline?
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
Which sometimes I wonder, are people offended by being called ordinary? But I wouldn't be.
Somebody would. You could say
somebody's
anything.
Somebody's going to be offended about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's such a great show. And we just did a couple of episodes on alopecia because it was Alopecia Awareness Month. And I had a young man who was just so great and just talked about what it was like and what some of the kids say to him. And
that was the little young kid in the blue shirt?
Yeah.
I saw that.
Because I guess blue is the color for Alopecia Month. So he and his mom both wore blue. I didn't know
makes
that.
Sense.
I was like, oh, I wish I knew. I would have worn blue too. But yeah, so it's a great show. Check it out. Yeah, so the other thing I was going to say, have you ever heard the theory of 1,000 yous? It's just such a great theory.
No, but I thought about that when I was on mushrooms.
So there's an actual theory. Let's talk about this sober. No, it's so
this
incredible.
This was years ago, by the way. People, this is
I came across it, and I'm going to botch it completely. So Robin's just going to make up her own version of this theory. But when you think about environment, nature versus nurture, all of those wonderful things that you know a lot about. Every person perceives every situation differently because of their history, because of what they've been through, because of their experiences. So when I meet you, that's one version of you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who you know of as yourself is a version of you. The guy at the grocery store who's bagging your stuff because of what he's seeing, that's a version of you. So there's thousands of versions of you. Does that make sense? Right?
Holy shit.
So even to your girlfriend, there is a version of Adam that is different.
Oh, definitely. I keep that one on point.
Because of her perception. And if because of her past experiences, it becomes that version.
God, anybody you've ever met. Or maybe not even met that just sees you as that guy that shops here on Monday.
Yes.
He's the one dude that shows up or the one lady that always does this and they've never even spoke to you. And they conceptualize your entire life.
Yes, and you know how I got to this? Because people always say to me, it's not because I care about what everybody thinks. It's just who I am. I always have. It's none of your business what people think is what people always said to me. And I never got that. I'm like, why is it none of my business? It's me, right?
Right.
But then when I read up on this theory, I was like, that makes sense because what you've experienced, what your personal perception is of me is none of my business. It's because it's based on your experience and your thoughts and processes. So it is none of my business. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I haven't got
and
to
I
the
can't control it because what, you know, your perception is your
perception. Do we try, right?
Yeah.
We do try to force the perceptions that people think about us or get offended if they think something opposite of what we're trying to put off or believe we are.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I'm just trying to think how many people I met in my life.
Right? So there's probably more than thousands of you out there. Isn't
oh,
that
God.
Interesting?
A bunch of matrixes and agents walking around in somebody's mind. This is trippy right now. All right?
I got I'm like, you, huh?
Yeah, yeah. That's trippy because, well, at least it would be cut off somewhere for some people, right? Because you heard of Dunbar's number, right? So Dunbar's number is the idea that we can only remember roughly 150 people in our mind.
Oh.
And that's it.
Okay.
And we can be reminded of a person when we meet them. Someone got booted out.
It's like a filing cabinet. You mm-hmm. only have so much room. Choop.
That's it.
Okay.
And so about 150 people is what Dunbar, I believe that's the Dunbar number, is 150 people is where it's at. So frankly, we could probably get close by going how if you knew how many people you ever met, but then you wouldn't know if they defiled you, right, and removed you from the hard drive. But and how many people you actually met? I mean, that's still a lot of people.
That's why I love the saying.
Right now, somebody's going, "What the fuck are they talking about?"
Well, we're two people. We're in people's files right now, so I don't know who got discarded.
Oh, I didn't even
sorry.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Oh my god! Like 200,000 plus something subscribers that have heard, and then they told people, "Holy shit!"
They had to boot
I got
two
billions
people.
Of perceptions out there. That's assuming if I stayed in someone's Dunbar number. Holy shit!
Yeah. Isn't that fascinating? So you know the saying where people may not always remember what you said, but they will always remember how you made them feel?
Yeah.
That's what I strive for.
Mm. Yeah. Mm, interesting. I remember how they made you feel. All right, so we.
Well, I pinch people as I walk by.
Well, I guess to remember an emotion, right, is to remember a thought associated. So, yeah, I guess remembering the feel. I'm processing that through, like, okay. Cognitive practitioner, right? Is that we can never just have a feeling. That all of our feelings come from thoughts.
Okay.
It's impossible to have a feeling, right? If somebody walk in, oh, I have a feeling about this house. I'm like, no, you thought it was haunted, and now you feel like it's haunted or something's weird with
Wait
it.
Wait a second. So is this...
Yeah.
Is this instincts that you're talking about, or no?
No.
Do you not believe in instincts?
Well, yeah, evolutionarily, yes. Right. Experience-wise, yes, right? Okay. We go through, for sure. I definitely believe in behavioralism aside.
I feel like I've had a feeling before I've had a thought.
Would be really difficult.
Hmm.
It would be really difficult because we would have our previous
let me think
experiences
about this and feel on this.
Right,
and I'll let you know.
It's whatever you're going to think will make what you feel. Right. So we've had previous experiences, and so based on previous experiences, a person may not even consciously think about the idea that this person reminded us of a person of a past experience, thus gave us a feeling around the person. When we're really pulling up conscious experiences,
I see that
into the conscious thought, thus creating the feeling we think we're supposed to feel sometimes, and or a feeling we think we just have.
Now I'm going to meet that, and I'm going to raise it to. I feel people's energy, and I truly believe that I feel people's energy, whether I'm right or I'm wrong. There are places where I feel it stronger.
Well, I would argue that to back you up, if we believe that. What we believe becomes the truth, right? So I often ask people, is there truth, Robin?
Our own.
All right, right. Yes. So we know that truth is perception.
Yes.
Right, so if truth is perception, right, whatever that belief is, right, so a past experience concretes beliefs, those belief schemas, those belief schemas of how we believe about people, places, things, ourselves, the world, others, those beliefs then generate how we think, right? So how we think then creates what we think. So what we do is we reach to the belief schemas, right, for very easy one, right? We call ourselves a political party. I don't have to actually think about the beliefs. I just know what I'm supposed to think, right?
Right.
So that's an easy one, right? But you can do it on other levels, right?
Is
so,
it easy, Adam?
the idea, right? It's not easy to hear, right? But the way that we just pull from those belief schemas, right? So if your truth is based in a belief that you do feel people's energies, then the thought is already existing as you approach people to
feel
for an
energy. So whatever
I
feel is because I already know that I feel.
Yes.
That I feel when I know.
Right.
That I know.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And a lot of people, it's hard for them to walk,
no,
but we're
I,
taken,
I
but as
it.
Humans, we do it like this.
Yeah.
So it's hard to slow that moment down and go, you know, right. what I do sometimes in a group to prove this, right? I said, let's say Robin's auditioning.
Okay.
Right. All right. And you're auditioning for me for a part for something, right? Show me joy. What are you thinking?
I don't know. I just said an expression, smiling or
but you had to think.
Yeah.
Right. You knew, yeah. But you know from previous experiences that reflects
that's
joy.
That reflects joy.
It's that half a second thought that pulls forward. That's what makes humans amazing is we can, all of that happens. In order to survive in this world, we have to have belief schemas to pull how we think from immediately. Right. Which is, I don't know if I believe that is the first person's response because does it match my beliefs here and can I get behind that? But I also believe the other way. That would be a cognitive practitioner, right? But I also believe the behavioralist, that repeated behaviors can reinforce or create new beliefs or challenge old beliefs that create new thoughts that shape
every
new feelings.
Behavior has a reason, whether it's a pleasant one or unpleasant or it's, you know, for a positive reinforcement and people confuse negative reinforcement all the time.
Reward's a reward.
Yeah. So negative reinforcement is not doing something negative to somebody. It's the removal of something. So let's say, you know, Johnny doesn't want to do homework and he's been really good today. So his negative reinforcement would be the removal of homework. See what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Sorry, it's just that it gets confused all the time, so I thought I would
define
that.
this is a realm I live
otherwise
in.
Otherwise, it would be a punishment. People think the word negative means negative.
Yeah.
It just means the removal.
Yeah. I've often talked about positive and negative as being so subjective, because the most negative thing that happens to us can sometimes be the catalyst for the biggest change and positive influence in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so to go out and say that's a negative, this is a positive. I try to do like optimistic and pessimistic, right? Or rational or irrational,
mm-hmm.
right? Those ideas. Because we can be, you know, we can frame a sentence or a belief to create a feeling that is positively irrational,
mm-hmm.
right? Like I'll never hurt anyone again. Right.
Right.
Sounds great,
right.
but not rational. Right.
Right.
It's especially
with 1,000 yous, because based on their
previous
experience.
I'm offending people all across this world continuously.
Based on their previous experience, you can't control how they're going to respond. You have to do what you're going to do. Right. You might hurt somebody, not intentionally. That wasn't your plan. But because of what they've been through, it hurts them.
Yeah. That's a pushback I get when I teach the cognition change is going, no one person, place, or thing makes you feel upset or angry. It's our perception downloaded to the thought to create the feeling, basically thinking we should be that. I call it shooting all over yourself.
Shooting.
Yeah, you should all over yourself.
You should all over yourself. I love that. I need a t-shirt with that.
Stop shooting all over yourself.
Yes.
Right? Well, you should have did this for me.
Yes,
you were
that's the name of your next book, Stop Shooting All Over Yourself.
Right?
Really?
Yeah, it was a form of a guy, Dr. Albert Ellis, who I'm sure you know. He would refer to it as masturbation.
That's funny.
That you must treat me well. The world must treat me fairly. Yeah. Others must treat me fairly. You know, we walk around with those.
Yeah.
It can be devastating.
Yeah.
I flip it as being like, it's our, that I think is honestly the superhero power, right? That we all hold as a human being that is so overlooked that we are superheroes, and the power of which that is, we all share the power, is the perception control to shape a perception of our experience, our present life, to create a story, to say it how we do, to change the feeling at any moment. That is fucking awesome.
Yeah.
That when I think of, you know, and if people can really download that, you know, but they're, no, I was on that roller coaster, damn it. You know what I mean? It's like, you should have been there, Adam. It was true. It was that. And, you know, what's the difference, right, between the two people that walk out of, you know, the burning building, right, and one is traumatic and goes to addiction while the other one's on stages giving speeches?
Yes.
What the hell? You know, it's the perception of that burning building.
Yeah.
But that I get hyped
just
about.
Like me being super grateful for a diagnosis. When people, every time I tell someone, oh, I'm sorry. No, don't be sorry. You should have seen me back then. It was awful, right? Now I'm healthier.
I say that about divorce. When people get divorced, I'm never like, I'm sorry. It's like, I always look at them like, well, you know, no good marriage ever ended in divorce. So why are we sorry? I'm like,
right.
Good for you. Good for you.
Good for you. Congratulations.
Right? I'm going to get emails. I'm used to it, people.
That's right.
There's filters.
Aw. And how do you feel about, I know, are you a parent?
I have to an adopted daughter.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Awesome. So how do you feel it is with us raising our kids today? Do you feel like we are softening things a little too much for them?
Yes.
Because when you were talking about, you know, something you said, I can't remember what it was, but it sparked a thought in me. And I thought, you know, we're doing too much to protect our children too quickly. So we forget that this is how we learn. Don't touch that because it's hot. Okay. Like when my kids were being raised, I did not remove everything from everywhere to keep them safe. I didn't pad everything. They have to learn. Yeah. It takes more work. You can't just sit back on your iPad and let them, you know, go.
Right.
You have to be on it, but I need them to fall. I need them to touch that and feel that it's sharp. Or obviously I wouldn't let them really burn themselves. But if I had a cup of hot coffee, that's very hot. And then they can tap it and see, ooh, that's the way you learn, is to go through it and to feel it. So I think that's where we're sort of going wrong, is that we're not allowing them to explore. Exploring is how we learn. Exploring is how, you know, we learn to grow. I touched that. That was hot. I'm not going to touch that again. My mom doesn't have to tell me. Because now I recognized it, right?
Yes. You know, it's, and I don't want to try to beat up on the millennials or all the generations under.
No.
Well, I fall into that.
Yeah.
Depends on which one you look
get
at.
Millennials get a bad rap.
Yeah. And I want to look at the parents, like, you raised them. Like, what the hell? Like, where's the fault with you?
Yeah.
Right? But I have a theory I'm working.
Okay.
I'm sure it's other people's theories too, right? I say it's mine. It's whatever. It's narcissism.
What's yours is yours. It makes it true.
That's right. It's mine. Damn it. you know, that, like you've mentioned, through struggle, we grow, right?
Absolutely.
Well, if one removes struggle in one's life, right, we see the rise of mental health diagnoses, right? The rise of anxiety, depression, suicide, almost a 14% increase in teenage girl suicide over a few periods, a few years, right? And, you know, we could argue it's social media, we could argue, right? But there were magazines and shit too, right? You know, that were out, right? But the rise, but...
I'm not going to say it's just social media. I think the internet and the access at hand is a little...
It's a lot.
It's a lot. And I think that our brains, especially at their young age, can't handle that.
Too much.
If we wanted information back when I was younger, you had to really explore for it. You had to go to a card catalog.
I was just thinking that.
Look through the drawer and find the number and then go. It was like almost like a, you know...
Yeah, that's why I didn't read.
And you had to find it. Now, it's literally... Literally all at our fingertips.
It makes them one of the smartest generations ever, though.
That, no, I disagree.
Really?
Potentially the smartest. They know that they don't have to do things. I have people who don't recognize in their own city where they're going because they just put their GPS on every time.
Sure.
So they don't even have to think about where they're going. So is that smarter or is that, you know?
They have more hard drive that's clear.
What happens if it shuts down?
Yeah.
Right? They're going to be at a loss because they haven't, like, even for me now, I will say I'm definitely dummier. I'm dummied down.
Well, confirms that one.
I used to remember everyone's phone numbers. I was like one of those people who just, you know, once you told it to me, I knew your number. I don't even know my kids' phone numbers. I'm not even kidding. Yeah. I know my husband's only because he's had it the whole time we've been together and I didn't, you know, have the cell phone then. None of them. I know none of their numbers. So if everything went out, so it's like we're so dependent on this. And if we want information, it's here.
Why remember it?
Why remember
it? Yeah. Well, that's kind of, yes. Right. I guess maybe I should say, maybe not one of the smartest generations, but the access to information immediately to be able to either regurgitate what they just heard. Maybe more blank hard drives, right? So they have a lot more RAM open.
They have more RAM.
You know what I mean? So it's like they're not filled. They're like, why do I got to remember that? I'll just.
Right.
Well, I felt that way in math class, right? When I had to take tests without calculators. I was like, what the fuck? That's a calculator. What are you doing? You know, it didn't make sense.
This is why it's more important than ever for us to be doing what we're doing as far as awareness and connecting with people. Because if you want information, you almost don't have to even go to school. You want the information. It's right at your fingertips at any computer. But what we need is to feel. We need to connect.
Well, that's the connection. You know? Yeah. That's the connectivity. To the theory I was processing, that's what I do. I'll come back.
That's what I do.
And we squirrel this way and we'll circle back. You turn. And so the idea that we have limited the struggle for younger generations. See, I think we have this evolutionary idea. It's in our body, right? To have struggle. And without struggle, I think the mind will create it in order to grow. Mm. And so the less that our children struggle, whether that's financially or any pick it,
in any way.
The way we all kind of did in our own ways. I mean, cause my generation had it way easier, right? Than the, you know, 60 years before me. Right. So as it got easier for us, you see the rise of mental health issues. Now we could say it's awareness or it's study about it. We can argue that, but you'll see as we've struggled less, you see the mental health matching it.
Find ways to.
So the mind will thus create a struggle, will create the anxiety, not saying it's not anxiety. It will create the depression, not saying that it's not depression. It will find ways to create itself a struggle in order to push past, to grow, to become better, the way we evolve.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I love Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, right? Nature always finds a way.
Yeah.
And possibly, evolutionarily, our brain is going, this is too easy. We are now depressed. What is self-actualization, right? You go to a developing country and see if someone has depression. Mm. It's not there.
Yeah.
Just want food. Right? Not to be murdered.
Survival.
Right. And so this doesn't happen. So the less struggle you see, the more rise of mental health issues become. Just to the working theory.
No, I love it. And I want to add to that and say that we're also reducing their need to strive for anything. Mm. So the whole everyone gets a trophy thing.
Mm-hmm. That's a problem.
Which people would think I would be on board with because I love people and I want to. No, it's a huge problem because we should want to strive. There are people who are naturally better at things and they should be rewarded for that. Or if you're not naturally, then if you work really hard, then you can become to that level. But if everyone just gets the same thing, then we're not pushing ourselves to the best of our ability. I think that's a shame.
It's I saw it. I coached high school football for a couple of years, very shortly. And, you know, of course, we all want to reminisce on our generation. Right. Yeah. I mean, of course, we want to do that. Yeah. I know this bias is present, and I'm sure it existed. But what I saw in the young ones, and through some others, I'll leave reasons or paths out, right? But I would see that a younger person would start something, and if they weren't, let's say, LeBron James off rip, if they didn't start it and they didn't perfect, they weren't going, this is my, they're all believe that there's some magical LeBron James gift in them, and they just need to discover that thing. And as soon as they discover the thing, they'll be the star at that thing. And that I see a lot. I see that constant of, I tried it, I wasn't perfect at it, I didn't do well at it, it must not be my thing. And so they bail on it in 10 minutes, you know, before working at it. And so there's this constant search for their passion, right, in quotes, right, that's just going to just emerge. And they'll be like, oh my God, I knew I was born to do X,
right?
Right, but I haven't found X. So what you wind up is someone that does nothing. That doesn't do much, right? Or does what they have to, right? And will resist against that instead of that push to, look, LeBron may have been born with some serious genetics and athletic ability, but that man works. You know, he practiced, he worked,
right,
he pushed himself to get that place, mm-hmm, right? You know, so it's not like we're just, you know, we're not born with that. You know, some are born with some talent.
Some natural talents, right.
Yeah, but unless you work that talent and push it, that passion, and make it, that points to you, everyone has a trophy, is that everyone has this gift that, you know, will just magically appear if they find it, you know, without working it.
Yeah.
And that's an issue.
It's an issue, baby.
It really is, man.
No, it is.
Yeah, I worry about the future probably too much.
Yeah.
I often think, but I also try to look from the other way, right, that I was going to go blind from watching the TV too close, right, that the Atari and Sega Genesis, yes, and Nintendo was going to make me not have friends. You know, that I heard that same shit,
right,
too, when I was,
yeah,
young. So I catch myself kind of going,
is,
you know,
is this a bias thing, or is this a, yeah.
Yeah. So, and you know, a lot of them hit the young ones up, right, that, you know, they don't know how to communicate right. And I think it was Gary Vee who I listened to him as well, but I caught him. I thought it was funny when he says, yeah, they know how to communicate. They just don't want to communicate with you. It's just not you, right? But they're doing it all the
time.
And
they communicate in a different way.
Right.
Where we had to communicate on our landline, you know, phones.
Pager.
Which we did for hours. A pager. Back in my day, the only people who had a pager was either a doctor or a drug dealer.
That's why I had two. Yeah, but yeah, it was, yeah, I do. I remember too, you know, I'm going to be sexist here. Somebody hashtag me. But it was, you know, the girlfriends of mine or whatever, it would be on the phone, you know, until mom was like, get off the phone.
Right.
Talking to their girlfriend like forever. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sorry, I didn't have my guy friends there call me like, so what you do today?
Because we had to get everything out. Now, you know, you get a thought, you can just text it real quick. And then 5 minutes, 10 minutes, an hour later, you can text again. Yep. But then we would have to, those conversations, we had to get it all out.
That's true. But you'll see them tomorrow morning at school.
Yeah, but that's something else is going to happen tomorrow morning.
Right? That's true, man. And who calls? Right? Like, I'm like,
oh my gosh.
I get a
weird
phone call. I'm like, what the?
I answer it now because I'm like, something's happened. If it's somebody I know, if it's a number I don't know, sorry, you're going to have to leave a voicemail.
I'm like,
but
selling me something. You know what I mean? You're getting the red button.
But yeah, no, I'll be like that. Oh, my daughter's calling me? That's so weird. What's going on? I got to answer it.
That's true.
Because usually they'll just text me.
Yeah, that's true. We communicate so quickly nowadays. I back to that point you were saying, I think it's too much information at once.
Too much.
Even
too soon.
Adults.
Yes. And yes. So in a world where we have access to communication 24/7, we communicate less than we ever have, like truly connect less than we ever have.
You certainly see the connectivity dropping off. It's wild. I do think as adults on up that there's, you didn't know, and I'm not saying you shouldn't, but you didn't know what was happening in Sudan. You didn't know what was happening. You know, it's such a flood of information. Mm-hmm. You know, that, I mean, if the Dunbar number theory is true just about people, you know, how much information, you know, and we tend to lean toward the violence. We tend to lean toward the dramas, right? This is what we're attracted to on TV, yeah. On news.
I mean, I hear you, but I think people also love, they love watching those little cat videos and the little, yeah. You know, little videos that just make you feel so good about maybe the person with a disability,
right?
That did something. Yes, it's so extreme, but I think it's anything that makes us feel. Right.
Yeah, that's the only curse word I don't allow in my groups at facility. I do. They all make jokes. I call them my seniors.
I said the F word.
Yeah, yeah. I have my seniors that are there. I call them the ones about to graduate, and then the ones kind of coming in. And it's funny how they'll educate them. Somebody will say the word. I just feel like, and they're like, no, you can't say that. I do that because I theoretically we use the word feel to remove personal responsibility.
Mm.
That. If you find yourself saying think, you realize you control what you think.
Right.
So if you're like, well, I just think that, you know, this group is terrible. You're like, well, what the hell are you thinking that for?
Right.
Right. Instead of going, well, you make me feel.
Right.
Right.
So now, I understand you don't like the F word, but something you understand what I'm saying, or something that just sparks an emotion in somebody.
Yes.
Something
I know.
Yeah.
I was just being an asshole.
Oh, right. I can handle it.
That they know too. Yeah. No, I just meant it. And I try to do that because a lot of people are way below their baseline. So it's trying to, you know, start somewhere, you know, and get to that. I find myself, I still feel. Yeah. Still, sometimes, I don't know.
You're like, I don't like it.
Do I still feel? I don't know.
Oh, you wouldn't do what you do if you didn't feel.
Oh, I appreciate that. Or you either, Robin.
Thank you. And what do I do, Adam?
Create ripples that have lasted for nearly 30 years, helping people, informing people, connecting people in ways. And you do that through... one channel of being concerned about others. Mm-hmm. And through that concern of others, it is allowed to create the ripples, sharing your own experiences of what you've been through, and realizing the impact that had on you, and then trying to share that ripple with others that has helped a lot of people.
Can I just like record that and use that at the beginning of each
did.
Of my shows?
We
oh, wait, it is recorded.
Yeah.
Aw, yeah. That's great. I appreciate that. And that is what I'm striving to do. So I'm trying to make you feel. I use the F word. So yeah, catch either Bake With Me on Facebook. Actually, Hoffy's Heart, because my last name is Hoffman. Hoffy's Heart started because my brother-in-law, this is how it all started, really. My brother-in-law had pancreatic cancer. So my family had a really rough couple of years. We lost 8 people in a 2-year period.
Shit.
Yeah. My mother included.
Sorry about that. My God.
You know, but this is, you know, so when he was diagnosed, he was 49 years old, and he kept telling me, all I want to do is make it to my 50th birthday, which unfortunately he did not. So from the date of his diagnosis to the date of his death was 3 months. Pancreatic cancer is.
Yeah.
Yeah. God. So he had never been married, and both of their parents had passed already. So, you know, he called me to the hospital. He texted me and was like, meet me at the hospital. I was like, yo, because we had already lost several people. He was actually the end of that 2-year period of loss. He was the last one. But I was like, I can't take anymore. What do you need me to be at the hospital for? Like, what's going on? Are you okay? And he's like, just come over here. And I was like, okay. So my husband and I went to the hospital, and he sat us down because I was just standing there. I'm like, what? I'm literally like, what? What is going on? He's like, just sit down. I was like, ugh. So he pulled up a chair next to him, and he had me sit down, and he said, I watched you take care of my mother, and I watched you take care of my father until they passed. He said, will you be my person? And I was like, I looked at my husband, and then I looked at him, and I was like, what is going on here? He's like, I have pancreatic cancer. He's like, we're going to fight it, but I don't know that I'm going to make it. So we had he didn't want to stay in the hospital. So we had him at his house, and I would just go, and the nurses taught me how to do all kinds of things. There's a reason I'm not a nurse, Adam. all kinds of things to take care of him. So I was changing his IVs and drain tubes and all kinds of great stuff. But anyway, so we would sit and talk, and all these ideas started coming as we were talking, because coming off of, like, not even coming out of all of this grief for the couple of years, losing so many people, I was just like, what the F is happening? And what are we doing? Like, I just felt like I needed to do more. And I told him about the idea for Bake With Me. And he got so excited about it. It was almost like he came out of, you know, all of the stuff that he was going through. Like he would step away from it for a moment to talk about, oh, we're going to get funding for you, Robin. You're going to do this. This is so exciting. It's such a great idea, you know. So because his name was Mark Hoffman, but he went by Hoffy. So because I'm a Hoffman also, when I created Bake With Me, my brand name is Hoffy's Heart for Mark. So, yeah. Because he was so excited about it and he was such a great proponent of it when he was alive. And after he passed, I was like, I'm going to do this. So I quit my job shortly after that and said, I'm going to make this happen. And that's how Bake With Me started.
That's an inspirational story by itself.
Yeah.
Oh, appreciate you sharing all this today, Rob.
Thank you. It's been great.
Thanks for having me. Let everybody know where they can find the shows and look them up.
Yes. So Hoffy's Heart on Facebook, which is why I mentioned that. You can check Bake With Me, but I think there's a couple other things. So if you put Hoffy's Heart, Bake With Me will come up. But Chat With Me is Chat With Me on its own. You'll find them both on Facebook.
Wonderful. And by the way, thanks for having me on the Chat With Me show.
You were great.
And for the mugs we got going over there as well.
I think you got a few thousand views.
Yes, did we?
Yeah, I think you did.
Oh, yeah. People chiming in, too, on the shows. I don't have my glasses, so I'm like, I can't read it. But I appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me, Adam.
Anytime you'd like to come back, let me know.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, you all. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. And we love you.